At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, so what's in it, what's not, and is it going to matter? Financial reform is one giant step closer to becoming law today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, everybody, the 25th of June. As always, good to have you here. The financial reform that Congress is going to vote on next week runs 2,000-some-odd pages. It took who knows how many hours of negotiations to get done. So really, there's no way we're going to be able to do justice to what's in it and what's not in a single broadcast. What we are going to do on day one, as other parts of the Marketplace empire digest the rest of the thing, is ask this question. Are we economically safer now than we were in the fall of 2008? Is the whole system safer and are consumers more protected? From New York, Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson starts us off.
If this bill passes, there will be a group of 10 people who are specifically responsible for making sure that no financial snowball grows big enough to take down the economy. Banks will also have to hold more cash, and their trading operations will be restricted.
I think consumers should feel safer.
Charles Gabriel is managing director at Capital Alpha Partners in Washington. He says the bill's requirement for greater transparency will give investors confidence that was sorely lacking during the financial crisis. People will know who owns what, who's trading what, and what safeguards are needed to keep everyone afloat.
This really was a very important step that the financial sector had to live through in order to return to a new normal. And the new normal won't be quite as profitable, but hopefully it will result in a very strong engine for the U.S. economy, and it should.
Then again, Gabriel is in the industry. Here's the view from Daryl Duffy, a finance professor at Stanford.
I'm not that excited. I had hoped that it would be a clearer step forward. It is a step forward, but not as dramatic a one as I had hoped.
Duffy says the bill is lacking when it comes to how a large, troubled financial institution will be dealt with. Overall, he says, the legislation leaves our financial fate to regulators, who will now have the tools to prevent another crisis.
Tools is even more concrete than what they've been given. They've been given authority and latitude, and now they'll have to build the tools and use them.
While regulators build their tools, Chris Lowe at FTN Financial reminds us what the banks will be up to.
A lot of what Wall Street does is they look at the regulation, which are sort of frozen in time, and they find the loopholes and take advantage.
That's a process that's already begun, even before the bill has passed and regulators have worked out the specifics. With the 30,000-foot view from New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
And I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith with the 30-foot view, wondering how all of this will affect me. Reed Kramer with the New America Foundation says, I'll be much better protected. The bill creates a new consumer watchdog, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
For the first time, there's going to be a single and empowered agency that can focus on shutting down the latest scams and gimmicks when they emerge.
The bill also cracks down on mortgage lending. Barry Ritholtz is the author of Bailout Nation. He says the bill finally creates formal underwriting standards for the mortgage industry.
There are no more of these no-doc liar loans, ninja loans. Lenders must verify income, credit history, job status.
Ritholtz says the tougher standards will protect us from banks and maybe from ourselves. But that's where it gets tricky, says mortgage banker Alex Stenback.
Who is a creditworthy borrower? That definition, that bar has been raised. But it also makes the process of getting a mortgage for the most creditworthy borrower more difficult.
And more expensive, says Peter Garuccio with the American Bankers Association. He says the cost of these regulations will ultimately be passed on to us.
It's very, very difficult to overstate the impact this will have on the business of banking, banks' bottom lines, and on the ultimate price consumers pay for banking products.
Garuccio says the regulations will drive many more small banks out of business, but Bailout Nation's Barry Ritholtz says the banks will be fine, and they'll keep lending.
If they don't want to lend, they could go make iPhones. But if you're a bank and you have deposits, how else are you going to make money?
Ritholtz doesn't think the bill goes far enough, but he says ultimately it does discourage lending to risky borrowers. And he says that's crucial for banks and the economy in the long run. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
So the long run, as Stacey mentioned there at the end. What is this bill going to do for the financial system in the crisis next time? Dan Groves covers business and the economy for Slate and Newsweek. Dan, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
If you assume, as most people do, that we are going to have another financial crisis at some point in the next 15, 20-ish years, does the bill that passed early this morning do anything to ameliorate that, to make it less harsh?
Well, almost by definition, we do not know what the next crisis is going to be or where it will come from. One of Wall Street's great skills is at innovating new ways to blow itself up. So this legislation is intended to forestall some of the things that got us into trouble, but it's hard to say definitively that this will forestall anything bad from ever happening again.
Well, then where might it do the best job? What have they done well in Congress?
One of the good things it has done is to set a marker to tell Wall Street firms and banks that you can't just have access to the Federal Reserve and the federal government insure all your deposits and then go do whatever the heck you want with it. It's setting down a marker to say, look, you can only put so much money into hedge funds and private equity. You can only trade certain types of derivatives. And then we're going to set up this risk council to look over things and make sure that the system is not getting too out of control.
Where did they then not do such a great job? Where did they miss the mark?
One has to do with leverage in terms of limiting the amount of debt these companies can have and use. That was what caused the downfall of Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and the whole investment banking industry, too much debt. A second is in not compelling the industry to pre-fund its own bailout. There had been talk of setting up a fund, $50 billion, $150 billion, to be funded by the largest institutions that the government could call on in times of need when a bank needs to be wound down or some interventions into certain markets were necessary due to a systemic problem. That is absent from the bill.
Does this thing, Dan, have a place in the context of the current economic recovery? Is anything in this bill going to make it better now?
As far as immediate impact or providing a stimulus, I don't really see any of that in here. But of course, that is not what this is intended to do. This is intended to, A, provide some sense of justice or sense that we have learned something from this crisis to try to prevent a lot of these things from happening in the near future, and ultimately to put the financial sector on a sound long-term footing, which helps for our economic growth in the long term, doesn't do a whole lot for us in the next couple of years.
Do you think that they made the most, that Congress made the most of the opportunity it had, that they took this crisis and turned it to its best possible advantage?
Absolutely not. They were not nearly tough enough on the credit rating agencies that played such a role in, you know, giving a stamp of approval to all these securities. They should have taken this opportunity to make the SEC truly independent in terms of keeping the revenues it raises rather than having to go to Congress every year for an appropriation. So there were a fair number of missed opportunities here.
Dan Gross, he's a columnist at Newsweek and at Slate.com. Dan, thanks a lot.
Anytime.
On Wall Street today, you know, since we're talking about it just a little bit, the major indices couldn't really make up their minds. The big banks did just fine. Thank you very much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. They managed to finish up the financial overhaul bill, all right, but Congress let an extension of unemployment benefits die last night. A Republican filibuster in the Senate took care of that. At least 1.2 million people have lost their unemployment check since the program expired on June the 2nd, and Brett Neely reports that may be bad news for a still shaky economy.
The emergency unemployment benefits weren't generous, says Maurice Emsellem at the National Employment Law Project.
Folks who have been unemployed for close to a year in many cases, they are not living large on $310 a week, I can guarantee you that.
But those modest payments have a big impact on the larger economy, says Heidi Shierholz. She's a labor economist at the Economic Policy Institute.
It's also really good stimulus.
That's because of how unemployment insurance works.
Those are people who are the most likely to have no choice but to spend it immediately in their local economies.
200,000 unemployed Americans are now losing their benefits every week, which means they're cutting back on food, gas, and other necessities.
It actually will add to the unemployment rate to reduce the benefits to long-term unemployed.
Economists predict that economic growth will start to slow because unemployment payments haven't been renewed. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
This was one of those weeks where the economic news just sort of built up slowly. There were some housing numbers early on, a couple of items about the G20 economic summit. And then this morning, the big reveal, the financial reform bill, making it through two key congressional committees. So that is where we start our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. Actually, not too far beyond Wall Street this week, actually. We've got Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine with us. Also, Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Kai.
Good to be with you, Kai.
So, Lee, let me ask you this. If I am a smart regulations lawyer for, say, Bank of America or J.P. Morgan or any one of the big banks, I am probably going to spend this weekend curled up with a beer and this 2,000-page law trying to find the loopholes, right?
Absolutely. And it might be, you know, a Chateau Petrus and you might be at your well, Southampton sure. home. But sure, I'm with you.
Sudeep, what would you do?
I think they might have some shot glasses out more to drown their sorrows than anything else.
Well, let me follow up on that, Sudeep. I mean, how do you think the banks came out of this thing?
Well, it certainly could have been worse for the banks. They came into this on the heels of a crisis that some of them actually created. And so they knew that they were going to face some payback with this. The biggest one that they're probably going to have uncertainty about is this Consumer Protection Agency, because we don't actually know how it will operate and what it will actually do. And so the battle is just beginning there in terms of coming up with the loopholes that they'll want to try to build into the regulations down the road.
But they are going to spend some time looking for ways to do that, right, Lee? They're going to figure out. I mean, the thing about Wall Street is they're the innovators and they're the ones who
Definitely.
Find the regulations and get them around them, right?
Definitely. I mean, you know, the blogosphere has gone crazy today, and I will add quite colorfully. The big headline has been, yes, Wall Street's getting off easy, and there's lots of loopholes, and there's lots of things to look at, especially, I think, in the category of derivatives reform. They have to sort of break off some of the derivatives they trade and do it under a separate entity, but not all. And, you know, just which kind of derivatives, that's what I would spend time looking at if I were that regulator. But I do think when we sit back and look at really what's happening, as Sudeep pointed out, there are some very big things in this bill, and it is pretty already landmark, but it's not going to prevent the next financial crisis. No regulation ever can.
You know, I was talking to Dan Gross a minute ago up earlier in the program, and he made the point that there is nothing stimulative in this bill, that it's all about safeguards and protecting us from the crisis next time. But I do have to ask, given the way the housing news has been this week and the fact that the president's on his way to the G20 up in Toronto to talk about the global economy, where are we in the economic business cycle? Are we double dipping? Are we feeling better, Sudeep?
We are feeling better than we were feeling a year ago, but there's still this deep concern about early withdrawal of stimulus, not for just us, but for all of the G20 countries that are going to be discussing this. It's how do we make sure that we don't immediately think that things are back on the upswing to the point that we can pull back a lot of the stimulus.
Mm-hmm. Lee, what's next? We've done a big stimulus bill. We've done a healthcare bill. We have now done financial regulation. What do you suppose comes out of Washington next?
Well, I think the financial reform is so big that I think just settling in and processing this and really figuring out where the recovery is going to come from and when, I think that's the next big conversation. I mean, I think, you know, talking about the markets, we really hit sort of a speed bump in late April and May with the crisis in Europe, which really came out of left field. Now we've got, you know, indicators like the housing numbers. And I think there's just a greater state of nervousness here that didn't exist just a couple months ago.
Sudeep, Lee said a minute ago, you know, it's tough to figure out where the economy is going to recover and where that's going to come from. What's your guess? Is it going to happen in housing, jobs?
A lot of this is just really about consumer confidence. It's certainly possible that we could see a recovery in the overall economy without the housing sector recovering, but that's really an indicator of consumer confidence. People need to feel better that things are at least on the upswing, and we don't have that yet. There's still this sense that unemployment is too high, and so we don't know what industry is going to come forward and create this next big boom that we need.
The funny thing is, I mean, for the past several months, several quarters, in fact, it was cost cutting that was allowing companies to post gains, and now we're starting to see sales are increasing for the first time in a long time across industries. And from the really important indicators from business itself, we are starting to see some good signs. But it's just sort of, you know, drowned out by all the other noise from everything else that we've been talking about.
Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine, Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, all this hard work people are doing, does it get the economy anywhere?
The people who are making the overtime, eventually they start spending again. When they spend, that money gets cycled back into the system.
Oh. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, a little up, a little down. The Dow Industrial slipped just under a 0.1% today, about 8 points. Closed at 10,143. The NASDAQ gained 0.25%, 6 points, ended at 2223. The S&P 500 added nearly 0.3%, that is 3 points, finished at 1,076. For the week that was, the Dow reversed 2.9%. The NASDAQ forfeited 3.7%. The S&P 500 gave back more than 3.5%. Banks, quite the other story today. Citigroup banked nearly 4.25%. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited nearly 3.75%. Goldman Sachs up 3.5% today. Bank of America scooped up 2.75%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell slightly to 3.11%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department tells us how much money we pocketed and how much left our wallets in May. Confirmation hearings begin for Elena Kagan to be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. She would succeed Justice John Paul Stevens. And it was a move uncommon in boxing. On June 28, 1997, Mike Tyson bit Evander Holyfield's ears, and then he was disqualified. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. All week long on the broadcast, our Shanghai correspondent Scott Tong has been explaining the economics of China's one-child policy, the law that limits Chinese parents to just one child. He's told us how and why the law came to be, what life is like for an only child in China today, and what the law means for China's labor force and, following on that, global prices. Today, the future of the one-child policy. We've got Scott on the line from Shanghai now to do that with us. Hello, Scott.
Hi, Kai.
So based on what we have heard from you the past 4 days, the one-child policy sort of does seem to have actually done what Beijing wanted it to do 30 years ago, right?
Well, what Beijing claims is that the policy has prevented 400 million births. More independent voices will tell you that the fertility rate might have gone down anyway for entirely different reasons. In 1980, when the policy came, every woman had about 3 babies. Now it's down to about 1.5. The original document reflected the idea that China had too many mouths to feed, and they wanted to control the population so they could have more to go around. Now, here's the downside of what the policy has created. It has created this upside-down ratio of old people to young people. Right now, about 15% of the population is over 65, but that's going to double by 2050, which is relatively okay for an advanced economy like the United States. But China, the fear is it's going to get old before it gets rich.
Any sense, then, that the one-child policy might change at all?
Well, it actually has changed a little bit over the past 30 years. There are a bunch of exemptions to the policy. Ethnic minorities, some people in the countryside are allowed to have 2 children. It's pretty complicated. There are hints that more incremental loosening could be on the way. The argument for change goes something like this. The one-child policy came back in the day when China didn't have enough grain or capital or consumer goods. Wang Feng is a Chinese-born demographer at the University of California, Irvine, and he says that is so 30 years ago.
There is no shortage of capital in China anymore. There is no shortage of consumer goods anymore. So the economy has changed. Demography has changed. However, the policy has not changed.
Now, for its part, the government says the policy is going to stay in place for several more years.
Even if it did change, though, Scott, it's not like things would change tomorrow, right? It would take a while to turn this economy around.
It would take a while if it turns things around. Mm. A lot of people I talk to in China don't want to have a second child. They say they can't afford it. And if you don't have enough young producers, that's an economic headwind that, you know, China is likely to have to deal with.
Well, let me pick up on that for a minute, because you've been talking this week in your pieces about economic costs and benefits. But it sounds like the biggest problems to come in the future are social.
Let me tell you a story.
All right.
I was sitting on a raft floating down a river, middle of nowhere, China, a few months back. And the man who was pushing the raft, kind of the bamboo raft man, was showing me some of the houses in the countryside. And a few of them had a second floor, even a third floor. And he said, you know what? Those are the rich families. They're trying to show their wealth so their sons can attract wives. In those areas, families have savings rates that are going up. The bride price in those areas, the dowry, is going up. And that is because we have this imbalance between boys and girls. Right now, for every 100 baby girls born, 120 baby boys are born. Historically, many Americans know that Chinese families tend to favor boys. So in a decade, we're going to have tens of millions of men here who cannot find wives. So for all the people who think China is this economic colossus that has everything figured out, the one-child policy has created a lot of internal issues that China is going to have to deal with.
Scott Tong in Shanghai for us, wrapping up a week's worth of coverage on China's one-child policy. He will be leaving China, Scott will, at the end of next month, coming back home, working in our Washington bureau for us. Scott, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
There's an economic report that we tell you about from time to time. Worker productivity. The most basic definition of it is widgets produced, whether those widgets are sales contracts signed or what have you, per hour worked. Productivity has been rising throughout the recession as companies try to keep up, while at the same time cutting costs by cutting workers. As the economy recovers and consumer demand rises, though, what those companies have been doing is adding hours, not people. In the manufacturing sector, overtime is up to more than 4 hours a week on average. That's compared to 2.8 hours just a year ago. And our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports that is good, and it's not so good.
Pam Haggerty is a regional sales manager who's based in Maine, but she hasn't been spending much of her time there lately. In fact, I caught up with her by phone in Kentucky to ask what the recovery has meant for her.
Exhaustion, I guess, is the first thing that comes to mind. I'm just so tired that the weekend isn't enough.
She explained that she was asked to add 3 states to her territory when a colleague was laid off.
Basically, I felt that it was either accept those terms or lose my job. So I instantly said, oh, of course, I can do it.
She can use the extra money now that business is picking up again, but she's worried that her more demanding duties are here to stay, especially since she's making it home a lot less often to see her husband, who's out of work himself. Haggerty laments the two of them have never felt so far apart.
My husband wants to go camping this weekend. I don't land until Friday afternoon, and then it's a 2-hour drive to my house from the airport. And then to think about, you know, packing up and going camping with the kids for the weekend, forget about it.
This is happening to workers across the country as businesses wring out some of their best profits in years. They're able to make more money with fewer workers for now. But Chicago-based job placement expert John Challenger says the pressure to hire again is building.
There will come a point when employers have no choice. There are many human resources executives today who are very worried that their very best people, the most productive up and down the company, are going to begin voting with their feet and leaving for greener pastures because you can only add hours for so long.
But deciding when to hire again can be a tough call, especially for smaller businesses. Mike Van Horn heads the Business Group, a consulting firm in Northern California. He says his clients are still worried the recession could return.
A lot of people say, whoa, there's a lot of people talking about double dip. We can't get bank financing. It's going to be very risky for us to be in an expansion mode, just hiring people with the expectation that the work will keep flowing.
It's a dance. You know, I don't really look too much to economic indicators.
Angelique Clark runs an interior decorating supply shop near San Francisco. She's encouraged that business is picking up, and she's been thinking seriously about hiring new help. For now, though, she's relying on OT.
I would give my current employees overtime as kind of a little thank you for sticking it out with me and going through it before I really jump on hiring a new person and going through everything. Because if I have to lay them off, then I've gone through all that, and then I have to pay workers' comp.
The future may seem uncertain, but all this hiring pressure on employers actually strikes James Altucher as a good sign. He's a hedge fund manager who blogs for the Wall Street Journal, and he sees what's happening now as the natural cycle in every recovery since World War II.
The people who are making the overtime, eventually they start spending again. When they spend, that money gets cycled back into the system. There's more demand for products, which puts even more pressure on the productivity of corporations until finally they have to cave in and start hiring more people, and the cycle continues.
Altucher thinks we're actually running ahead of schedule. He is known as a Wall Street bull, but he sees a big pickup in full-time employment by the end of the year. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, seeing as how we haven't said the words BP or oil leak yet in the broadcast, here's your update. First of all, the IRS wants folks down on the Gulf Coast to make sure they don't forget the tax man. IRS Commissioner Doug Shulman said today he's going to run a bunch of workshops down there to answer questions, but he said compensation checks to cover lost wages are indeed taxable. On another note, there's a storm brewing down in the Gulf. It's expected to turn into a tropical depression sometime this weekend, and that could force BP to stop collecting oil from the leak. In response, company shares fell another 6%.
8% today. They are now $26 a piece, down 60% or more, even from where they started back on the 20th of April. And on a Friday, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow down 8 points, just under a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ up 6 points, a quarter percent. The S&P 500 gained 3 points, nearly 0.3%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, on the Gulf of Mexico, you make your living in fish or oil. For some families, though, it's both.
The shrimping industry is no longer, so there's no income coming in. And if he holds drilling, then I may lose my job.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back here same time Monday. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
Oscar Gomez was a Chicano student activist in the 90s, a radio DJ, and a rising star.
He was fire. He was charisma incarnate. Everyone had a crush on him.
He was a voice of people who didn't have a voice.
Until his sudden and mysterious death. What happened to Oscar? Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.